The Joint Committee of Public Safety, Civil Law, and Government Operations will come to order. This is an informational hearing. Because of the lateness of this bill, we wanted to make sure that the three of the committees that have some jurisdiction over Representative Moline's bill had an opportunity to, A, hear the bill and ask, B, ask any questions that they might have. And we are going to take public testimony. And the agenda for today was that we'll have Representative Moline walk through the bill. You can ask questions as she's going through the bill. And then we will take public testimony. Then I'm going to turn it over to Representative Lesch, who is chair of the Civil Law Committee, and he can go through those provisions. And then when he is complete, we will turn it over to Representative Nelson. He will go through the rulemaking and task force issues that would be under the auspices of government operations. If that works, and hopefully get out of here by 7:30 or earlier, depending on how much time we need. Okay, so with that, Representative Moline, welcome to the Joint Committee. And are we operating under the off the DE2 amendment, I take it? Right? We have that.
MS 102?
Mr. Chair, it would be the unofficial engrossed version, the MS 102 that you have in front of you, that we had adopted in Ways and Means Committee this morning.
Okay, I see. Okay. Got it.
This will be the final language, Mr. Chair. It's just not the revisor's version.
Okay, I see. Okay, do you want to just walk us through it? And members, if you have questions, you can interrupt.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and members, for having me here this evening. And we're here on the Medical Cannabis Therapeutic Research Study. As many of you know, there has been a number of compromises throughout session. And, you know, this bill, although my original bill passed through Health and Human Services, quite a while ago, that version got hung up, and we were able to come to a compromise with some stakeholders and move this new language forward. This language is would implement an observational research study, which is slightly different than the clinical trial model that you may have heard about last week regarding the study of medical marijuana. And it would allow limited participation by patients who have a qualifying condition. The way that they would be able to have access or be enrolled into the program would be if their practitioner certifies that they have a qualifying medical condition. The qualifying medical conditions listed in the bill are cancer, glaucoma, HIV/AIDS, Tourette's, ALS, seizures, severe and persistent muscle spasms such as MS, Crohn's disease, and any other condition that is approved by the Commissioner of Health.
Representative Moline, can you just sort of, when you get to these places, let us know where in the bill those are, because not everybody's heard the bill before.
Sure. If you want me to go through...
Yeah, why don't you just take us through it? I think it's not that long of a bill, and we... You don't have to go through all the definitions, but just tell us. Yes, okay. Right now? Representative Lesch, right out of the gate.
You don't have to explain a bunch of the bill first, but technically it's not out of the gate.
Mr. Chair, Representative Moline, how did you arrive at this list of what meets the criteria for being able to use this medicine?
Representative Moline.
Mr. Chair and Chair Lesch, these are conditions that right now there are 20 states in the District of Columbia that have legalized medical marijuana, some of them for well over a decade. And so we do have sort of observational research out of these other states of what conditions respond well to the treatment of medical marijuana. There's also studies that have come out of other countries. We have federal laws that prohibit those kind of formal studies here in the states, but we do have medical studies coming out of other countries. And these are the conditions that we know respond well to that treatment. All these conditions were in my original bill. The only conditions that were in my original bill that are not in this language are PTSD, intractable pain, and severe and persistent nausea. So other than those three, these are the conditions that were in the original language.
Representative Lash.
Mr. Chair, I'm wondering because, like you said, Representative Moline, we've had decades of data and anecdotal evidence of what this works for and what doesn't. So you're probably going to go into why this is termed a therapeutic research study, because from what I understand and what you described is, I'm not sure what else we're actually studying. But I don't know a lot about, and maybe you talked about this in HHS, about why that's the case, so I don't want to go into it here, but I probably will have other questions of other folks regarding this list, so thank you.
Okay, Representative Moline, so let's just say we're on page two, since you've covered that. That's the qualifying medical condition. So you want to just take it from there then? Unless anyone has any questions on that section.
And, Mr. Chair, there are patients here that have some of these conditions that I know want to testify as well, so we can hear more about that. One section of the bill that I didn't cover on the first page was we only allow administration of medical marijuana through a liquid, oil, pill, or vaporized delivery. So there's no smoking permitted. And the Commissioner of Health is able to permit another delivery method if science would come along and something else would prove to be an effective delivery method for patients. The Commissioner has the opportunity to add another delivery method. On page 2, subdivision 2 is limitations for where the patient can use their medical marijuana. It's limited to basically, essentially, private locations. So not on a school bus, not in a school or a correction facility, no public transportation. And a patient cannot vaporize where the vapor would be inhaled by a minor child if that child is not a patient, and cannot use the vaporization in any public place. And, of course, cannot use while operating a motor vehicle. On page 3, we have language regarding federally approved clinical trials. Basically, there's a big issue with federal law as far as getting federally approved clinical trials. It usually takes about a decade. And even at that point, it would be very unlikely that you would have any federal approval of the use of medical cannabis. Some places have been successful in obtaining that after many, many years. So what we say is, if by chance somebody is enrolled in a federal clinical trial, then they may not qualify for the enrollment here in Minnesota. Beginning on page 3 are some of the duties of the Commissioner of Health and the Department of Health. And essentially what we do is require that the Department of Health register and regulate one manufacturer for the cultivation and manufacturing of medical marijuana within the state. So, again, with the interactions with federal law, in order to have an effective medical marijuana program, you have to have an in-state source. There's no opportunity to sort of bring this medicine in from other states due to violations of crossing state federal law and crossing state lines. So this provides for one manufacturer in the state of Minnesota that the commissioner has to register and regulate. There's a $20,000 application fee for the manufacturer, and if they're not selected by the commissioner, then they have $19,000 of that refunded. It sets forward what considerations the commissioner is supposed to make in determining who the manufacturer should be, including, you know, their technical expertise, their qualifications, their financial stability, their ability to meet supply, and some other conditions that are set forward. On page four, the commissioner is, after reviewing medical and scientific literature, is supposed to set a range of chemical compositions and a range of dosages that are known under sort of existing literature on what would be beneficial for each specific condition. So we know that there are over 200 compounds in the marijuana plant, and they use different compounds to treat different conditions. So the commissioner is supposed to put together a list of what the medically beneficial compounds will be for each qualifying condition, and provide that list to the manufacturer on the department website, and as along with dosing as well.
Representative Emily, can I just go back to the manufacturer? So in Ways and Means today, that issue came up, and I'm just wondering if you had any more time to think about it, that this will be one manufacturer, and understand the reason for wanting to do that, so we have a consistent cannabis medicine that is being used. But how will this manufacturer be chosen? Will they be in state, out of state? You talked earlier about that possibly being nonprofit, but that there was some concern raised about having just one manufacturer and the money involved there, and what, and there doesn't seem to be anything in the bill that would regulate the manufacturer vis-a-vis the prices they would charge the patients.
Mr. Chair, the language regarding the one manufacturer, I think we heard from the Commissioner of Health earlier, they think it would be important for as far as collecting data and quality control, so there's consistent reporting, to only have one manufacturer. I think, you know, it'd probably be in the best interest of the program and patients to have a manufacturer that is already established in another state and sort of knows what they're doing, and they have the expertise, which is why we have language in there that they have expertise into making these medicines in other states. I guess I sort of envision that those will be the people that will come in and apply with the Department of Health to be the manufacturer. And then the commissioner, you know, looks at the qualifications set forward and determines who the manufacturer is going to be. As far as pricing, I think that there's language regarding the Department of Health consulting with the manufacturer for what a reasonable fee would be. And I know that we're looking at language possibly for a floor amendment dealing with some price gouging issues as far as a financial audit would go, to make sure that patients are paying a fair and reasonable price, because I share those similar concerns. When you sort of set up a monopoly, you can get into a situation where there is price gouging. So I think we do have something in the works to address some of those concerns.
Very good. I think that was the other thing I forgot to mention, members, that the purpose of this informational meeting was to start thinking about possible floor amendments to improve or enhance the bill, or you know, however you look at it. But that's something that came up in Ways and Means that I think needs to get addressed. So,
Tina.
Representative Lesh, then Liebling.
Mr. Chair and Representative Moline, it seems to me that we're setting up a large infrastructure and bureaucracy for distribution of a medicine that can be the product of something you grow in your backyard. And I'm wondering, are the reasons for that limited to concerns that the medicine can be abused, or is there other reasons of why we're setting up this size of an infrastructure?
Representative Moline.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Chair Lesh. I think that there were some public safety concerns regarding the home cultivation and that it could result in diversion. But more so, I mean, with the research studies that the department is going to do, they were very concerned about quality control. And I know that obviously these conditions are people that already have suppressed immune systems, and there is a danger in getting a contaminated product. So having it cultivated in a very controlled environment that's subject to third-party independent lab testing, I think is not only in the best interest of the patient, it also helps in gathering accurate research, and it also addresses public safety concerns. So I do think that there's a benefit in having a very controlled environment in where this medicine is processed.
Well, I would just say that, Mr. Chair, and that may be the case, and we have yet to hear from law enforcement's concerns about this. I'm not apprehensive about this language necessarily because of the concerns of law enforcement. I'm concerned because once any industry gets their hand on it, be it pharmaceutical industry or any other case, it starts to get removed from the normal, I guess what I would say, expectation desires from the average consumer, because the industry is in it for very specific reasons that aren't necessarily in it for the same reasons the consumer in it for. So I would love it if we could find a way to cut out that process. But that's all I'll say.
Representative Liebling, and then Howe.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Representative Moline, I'm excited to hear about this new version because, of course, I've been hearing about it in the press but haven't been able to actually read the bill. But as I'm listening to the discussion about this one entity that would be the manufacturer, I just wanted to see if you've had any conversation with the Board of Pharmacy, because as I'm looking at this, a lot of the things that you're looking for in this manufacturer are things that for other kinds of drugs fall under the Board of Pharmacy, and they are in the business of licensing pharmacies, and they even do this a little bit around financial stability. I know we passed a bill in which there are provisions about yanking a license for tax problems in a pharmacy and things like that. So they even oversee those entities for financial issues. And so it just occurs to me that we might already have sort of an entity in the state that could provide the oversight that you're looking for, and not that they necessarily would want to. I don't know. I just wonder if you've talked to them.
Representative Moline.
Mr. Chair and Representative Liebling, I did speak to the Board of Pharmacy, and we do have language in the bill that actually requires the manufacturer to have licensed pharmacists employed there at the manufacturer, which was at the request of the Board of Pharmacy. There are actually some federal licensing issues with pharmacies themselves. Medical cannabis can't be distributed from a pharmacy, but licensed pharmacists can be employed by a manufacturer. So we do have language that requires that they have board-licensed pharmacists on site. I hadn't thought of the angle of them being involved in any sort of audit or price gouging sort of aspect of it. I could further my discussion with them in that regard, but they are required to be employed by the manufacturer.
So, Mr. Chair.
Representative Leland.
So, thank you. Thank you, Representative Moline. So, would the board be providing some kind of oversight to this entity, or did they offer anything along those lines other than providing pharmacists, which sounds like a very good idea? But in terms of the entity itself, even though it isn't formally a pharmacy and under the federal rules, they certainly are the board that has expertise.
Representative Moline.
Mr. Chair, Representative Liebling, no, there's no language that the Board of Pharmacy has any sort of oversight. Again, our only language is that the pharmacist be employed by the manufacturer. And then the task force that we set up, it's required that a licensed pharmacist serve on that task force as well, but no board of pharmacy oversight.
Okay, we have Representative Howe and O'Driscoll, and then maybe we should have Representative Moline go on into the bill. Representative Howe.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And my only question is it goes to the first part of the bill, the first page, and I guess when I looked at this and it said pill, I was under the understanding that Marinol, which I believe is a derivative now of marijuana, isn't that currently being prescribed today?
Representative Moline.
Mr. Chair, Representative Howe, Marinol is a synthetic THC. It's just THC in a pill form. That leaves out a lot of other compounds that are medically beneficial to the patient that wouldn't be provided through just the sole dose of THC. So what patients have found is it's not effective for many patients.
Somehow.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I guess that wasn't where I was going. My question is that now going to fall under here, under this bill, or is that currently still going to be regulated however the Board of Pharmacy regulates it? I guess I'm questioning, I don't know where that, which takes jurisdiction over something like that then.
Do you know the answer to that?
Well, Mr. Chair, Representative Howe, Marinol is a FDA-approved synthetic THC. So that won't fall under the purview of this bill at all.
Representative O'Driscoll.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I may actually, with my questions, kind of get us back onto the track that you'd like to be on here. And I guess it's more of a global framing question. And I guess I would ask if it's appropriate for Representative Moline maybe to backtrack a little bit and talk about why states are finding it important for them to regulate and to bring forward at the state level these types of things when we have an FDA which is charged with national health-related issues and medical and food and drug and those kinds of things, and why the federal government is not taking this on, and why we would have to at the state level be looking at this. It's just something that's always been nagging at me, and as I'm going through and hearing about the different provisions, I've kind of thought, well, maybe I'll just wait till the next page. And it's like, well, there's more questions about this, the integrity of the growing products and the environments in which they're going to be harvested and manufactured, and the delivery systems and the types of ailments that we would be looking at. I guess I'm just wondering why the states are needing to do this and talking about bringing things across state lines and the criminal aspects of some of those kinds of things. I think that's why we have an FDA to be able to do those. I'm just wondering why the FDA has been reluctant to do this, pushing it down to the state level. And maybe that's a little bit deeper than we want to go, but it sure has been a question that's been on my mind for an awful long time since we've been discussing this issue.
It's not allowed federally. But Representative Moline,
Mr. Chair and Representative O'Driscoll, that's a somewhat complicated question. So the federal government has marijuana as a Schedule I drug, which is considered to have no medical benefit and be the most dangerous drug. It's actually scheduled the same as heroin. It's actually scheduled as being more dangerous than cocaine and meth. It was added into that schedule in the 1970s as part of the war on drugs. Because of that scheduling of the Schedule I drug, people cannot research it in what we would traditionally think of researching a drug to see the medical efficacy. So for decades, doctors and medical research facilities have been requesting from the federal government to be able to conduct actual research on marijuana, and because it's a Schedule I drug, they can't. And it's actually not the FDA that's the problem. The FDA has approved several drugs or several trials and tests and formal research. But because it's a Schedule I drug, the DEA, the Drug Enforcement Agency, and NIDA, the National Institute on Drug Abuse, can actually override the decisions of the FDA. So you have three federal agencies fighting with each other on whether or not there can be federal approval. And so while the FDA has tried to conduct studies, the DEA has stopped them from doing so because of the scheduling of the Schedule I drug. So unless the federal government rescheduled marijuana to be a Schedule II drug, you run into all sorts of federal law problems with being able to do a sort of formal clinical trial or formal FDA approval of any drugs.
Representative O'Driscoll.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Representative Moline, that's very enlightening. And I guess the next question I would have, and then I would defer back to the chair to keep us back on track with other issues, is what would prevent the federal government from seeking an injunction or saying, you know what, we've got a lot of states that are out there doing this at the state level. We're just going to step in and stop this. And my fear is that we're trying to help people. That's not my fear. That's my hope that we're helping people. My fear is that we get down the line, people are seeing benefits from this, and the federal government steps in and says, we're going to take a different approach on this. And everyone who's been receiving benefit from this is now back to square one. And that's a fear that I have, again, with whether the federal government's regulatory authorities, and you said there's three agencies that are arguing about this, and I would like to do it once and do it once right so that we don't have those kinds of unintended consequences or byproducts. And I don't know if you have any additional information on that, but that's maybe just more of a comment, and if you'd like to comment it, Representative Molina, I'd be interested to hear what your research or your findings have found.
Representative Molina, why don't you comment and then take us back to the bottom of page four, maybe, and get... We'll start the patient registry program.
Mr. Chair and Representative O'Driscoll, you know, unfortunately, in this circumstance, we can't write any state law that would overpower the federal government. There's no absolute guarantee that they couldn't do that. They couldn't come in and shut down the program. But there are 21 states that are doing it, and some of for decades, and that hasn't happened. The Department of Justice has said that they will not prosecute patients, they will not prosecute practitioners, and they will not enforce federal drug laws against medical marijuana patients and programs in states. They've done all that under the 10th Amendment, which is why we have that issue of being able to get medical marijuana from other states into Minnesota, and why states have to set up their own program, because all the federal rulings have been done under the purview of the 10th Amendment and states' rights. So, you know, that's been the biggest barrier. But, you know, I would say that several states have had this for decades, and there hasn't been any problems. There's also federal court opinions that conversations regarding medical marijuana between a doctor and a patient are protected by First Amendment rights. So, you know, there's opinions from the Department of Justice and federal court opinions that do provide protections. But, you know, ultimately, there's no absolute guarantee.
We're going to take Representative Neuberger had one more question here, and then we need to move on.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Moline. Question I have goes to the very first section. It's a clarification of the definition here. On line 1.6 is where you start. It says a healthcare practitioner means a Minnesota licensed doctor of medicine, a Minnesota licensed physician assistant acting within the scope of authorized practice, comma, or a Minnesota licensed advanced practice registered nurse, primary responsibilities patient care. I get that. So I guess what I would like to have clarified here is, a doctor could prescribe this. A physician's assistant could do that as long as they are within their scope of authorized practice, meaning that they are under the purview of a medical doctor. That's clear to me. The part that I would like to have you clarify here is it says, or a licensed advanced practice registered nurse. Now, will these nurses be able to prescribe this of their own accord, or will they have to do that under the direction of a doctor like the physician's assistant does?
Representative Moline.
Mr. Chair, these practitioners all have prescribing authority. So they can prescribe any medication. I go to an advanced practice registered nurse. I mean, they can prescribe morphine, Oxycontin, you name it. So the only practitioners under this bill that would be able to enroll a patient already have prescribing authority under Minnesota law.
Well, I think we're going to have a little clarification here. Representative Liebling.
Right, Mr. Chair and members, actually under current law, advanced practice registered nurses need a written prescribing agreement with a physician. However, that may change soon, but that is current law.
Yeah, and under under this bill, Mr. Chair, just to be clear, it's not the... We use the word prescribing, but it's not what you would normally think of as a prescription because you're not going to the pharmacy. So prescribing isn't exactly the right word. Patient enrollment.
Okay, let's move on. Representative Moline.
Okay. Where am I at here?
Well, I thought you were at the bottom of page 4, but maybe I...
If you haven't hit the rulemaking piece of
that. We haven't hit the rulemaking piece. So you're on page 4, I thought.
Mr. Chair and members, there is a rulemaking provision that requires the commissioner to adopt rules to implement this section. Is this expedited?
Mr. Chair.
Representative Nelson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And as I read this on 410 to 413, there's one set of rulemaking there. And then on 420 to 422, there's a second set of rulemaking there. Is that redundant or is that two different things?
Representative Moline.
It's 410 to 413. It's the commissioner shall manufacture or for make, adopt rules necessary for the manufacturer. And then the second piece. It says subdivision 5 rulemaking, it's shall adopt rules to implement the section. Is that saying it twice? Is that being redundant or is that two different things?
Mr. Chair and Chair Nelson, I think counsel is going to explain that.
Mr. Chair,
members. Can you please introduce yourself for the record?
Jamie Olson with House Research.
Okay.
They're not redundant. They actually go together. On line 4.10, that's an instruction to the commissioner that any rules necessary to make the program effective by July 1st, 2015, which means that the manufacturer would be distributing the medical cannabis by July 1st, 2015, this instructs the commissioner that those rules need to be published in the state register by January 1st, 2015. On line 4.20 is the broad rulemaking authority granted to the commissioner, also coupled with the instruction that any rules published in the state register prior to January 1st, 2015 are through the expedited rulemaking process.
Representative Nelson.
So that was going to be my next question. So you're anticipating it going through the expedited process that we're... Is that the one that we're passing, or is that expedited process as currently in law?
Ms. Olson.
Mr. Chair and Representative Nelson, it would be whatever section was in law in section 14389 at the time that this is passed.
Got to think about that. Okay.
Okay. Representative Moline, please continue.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. And then to the patient registry program. This requires the commissioner to give notice and explanation of the registry to healthcare practitioners, allows participation in the registry program by each healthcare practitioner in the state who meets the qualifications and requests to participate in the registry program, provides information to the healthcare practitioners, creates written certification for healthcare practitioner to use when certifying a patient's qualifying medical condition, and then also includes an option for healthcare practitioner to certify that a patient, as a result of a disability, is unable to self-administer medication. The reason we have that language in there is, we know we're dealing with some pretty serious conditions, some hospice patients, other patients that lack the motor skills to administer their own medication. So if the doctor certifies that they have a qualifying condition and that they're unable to self-administer medication, then the Department of Health, through another process that I'll get to, is able to certify a caretaker for that person, and that caretaker is able to administer medicine to people who are unable to administer it to themselves. Under this section, the commissioner also supervises the participation of the healthcare practitioner in conducting patient treatment and health records reporting, develops safety criteria for patients, and then conducts the research and studies based on data submitted from health records. And this would be the duty of the practitioner to report back to the Commissioner of Health on how the patient is responding to the treatment. It requires the commissioner to develop a patient application for enrollment in the registry program that includes listed information, including but not limited to the healthcare practitioner's certification of diagnosis. And then again, it requires the commissioner to register that a single designated caregiver if the patient enrolled in the program is unable to administer medication to themselves. Requires the commissioner to enroll
Excuse
the patient.
Excuse me, Representative Moline. Representative Hanson.
Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Moline. So I'm trying to think about this as just from a practical perspective. So what if I get a diagnosis of a terminal illness and I'm dying? How long is this going to take? And what if I have no family, no friends, I'm at the end of my life and I'm dying and in pain? So how is this bill, how am I going to work through this?
Representative Moline.
Mr. Chair and Representative Hansen, you would have to get the certification from your practitioner that you have a qualifying condition, and then you would have to submit that through to the Department of Health and be enrolled in the program. I think that I have to look at the current legal guardianship laws, but I imagine if a person is incapacitated and under some sort of legal guardianship or has a healthcare directive and has a legal appointed healthcare agent, typically those documents allow for that healthcare agent or legal guardian to act for a patient. I don't see why this would be contrary to that law. And so I think there would be a mechanism in order to submit that form to the commissioner. What the turnaround time is, I can't say for sure that if somebody gets a diagnosis that they only have, 3 months to live. I don't think there's any certainty that they're going to be able to have access to medicine within that brief amount of time. And, of course, it gets difficult to legislate for every scenario, but we tried to make it as speedy as possible.
Representative Hansen.
So, Mr. Chair, and I'm just thinking of a practical perspective here, so... let's say you could just your doctor prescribed you morphine and you are in pain and you have that would be simpler, but there's side effects, so you're out of it, you're out of it with the pain and the morphine. And you want to try something else, but you can't. So the default here is to use the existing system, which may be a medication that is legally available. You don't have to go through this mechanism that we've set up for this. Is that correct?
Representative Moline.
Mr. Chair and Representative Hansen, I think that the language in the bill would possibly allow the Department of Health to set up rules to address those sorts of issues. But right now, there's no language that would provide a clear mechanism for somebody who has a very short time frame and is in incapacitated state in order to enroll, get the medicine they need in a very timely fashion.
Representative Hansen, I would, these are the kinds of questions that we should be asking. And if you or any other member thinks that these are appropriate amendments, I think that now is the time to start thinking about them, because this is the only time we'll have to amend this bill since it's gone through Ways and Means is on the House floor. Representative Russo, are you done, Representative Hanson? I'm sorry.
Well, I've dealt with a family member going through this, and it's not a pleasant experience. And I'm trying to think of what you would do to go through this to get relief versus being provided with morphine that you're hardly a human being anymore. And so, I understand the intent, and I understand trying to make this work, but I see a bureaucratic system set up here that all of us are going to die at some point in time.
It's a question of how it goes. And I think if I was exiting and I was in extreme pain and I had to look at, is this what I want to do? It's not. We're not thinking about how do I make sure that I'm not causing some gateway drug. That's not what people are thinking about. And I think that's what we have to ask ourselves when we debate this on the floor. And I understand what you're trying to do.
Well, Mr. Chair,
Representative Lane.
And Representative Hansen, just for clarity purposes, in the full bill that had a full vetting in Health and Human Services, there was also not a mechanism to address the sort of situation that you bring up. I understand that it's a concern. Under this bill, it would have to be within 90 days because the certification has to be 90 days prior to when the commissioner gets it. But I think that you use the word bureaucratic, and while this bill may be more bureaucratic than the other one, I just want to be clear that the other bill also didn't address that sort of scenario. So, and that did have a full vetting in the Health and Human Services Committee. But you certainly bring up valid points.
Representative Yaruso.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And kind of continuing on the same line about the single designated caregiver kind of kicking this off, but first a comment, I think, in an institutional hospice setting, we might have difficulties with federal law, but I'm no expert on that. But I'm thinking of the, I'm wondering, does the single designated caregiver, is the intent of that to have that single person be the only person who could administer the medicine?
Representative Lane, I believe that was taken out of your, that's not the way your bill works anymore now, right?
No, Mr. Chair, there is language regarding a caregiver, and yes, there could only be one single designated caregiver per patient.
Oh, caregiver, I see.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair, sorry. What I'm wondering is, does that mean that's the person that would be responsible for receiving and caretaking, taking possession of the medicine, or would that be the only person that would be authorized to administer it?
Representative Mullane.
Mr. Chair, yes, that would be the only person authorized to administer it.
Representative Russo.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. In that case, I have some concern with that because I'm thinking of the person. One of the conditions that's listed is this in severe muscle spasms, and that can happen in a number of disabling conditions, MS, cerebral palsy, dystonias, and so on. And a person who suffers from such a condition may require a personal care attendant, perhaps all day, perhaps just at different times of the day, and because of the 24/7 nature of that, unless that's your mother, that's unlikely to be the same person all the time. People have to go through shifts of people, particularly if they're in an assisted living situation or something like that, but even if they're in their own home and hiring people. And so, because this is not really, it's not addressing mental incapacity, it's addressing also physical incapacity to be the person that administers it to yourself. So I think this might be one of those areas that's ripe for some thought.
Representative Moline, I hope someone as staff is keeping track of some of these issues that are being raised, because it's not, Representative Moline, I don't want to put you on, you shouldn't be doing this. I'm hoping staff is keeping track of the issue that Representative Hansen has raised, Representative Russo has made, possible amendments for the House floor. That's the purpose of the meeting. Representative, are you done, Representative?
Yes, thank you.
Representative Drazkowski.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Representative Moline, for bringing this bill forward. And I apologize I missed the first part of the hearing. My first reading of this first blush is similar to Representative Hansen's. It appears we're creating a bureaucracy here. Representative Moline, I guess I'll just ask a question directly. Why was it your choice to place into the bill this and place the Department of Health between the doctor and the patient?
Representative Moline.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Representative Drazkowski. There, maybe you weren't, when I was talking about the federal licensing issues, so under federal law, a doctor can't directly administer medication or medical marijuana to a patient. They can't sort of write them a prescription, per se, to the patient. There has to be sort of a buffer zone in between the doctor and the patient due to federal licensing issues. But I don't know that I would describe it as putting the department between the doctor and the patient. The doctor or the practitioner makes the determination on whether or not the patient has a qualifying condition, and the patient then enrolls into the program with the Department of Health and then continues treatment with their primary practitioner who reports those findings to the department. So I don't know that I would describe it as putting the department between the doctor and the patient. But
Representative Drazkowski, follow up, and then we'll go to Representative Uglem, and then we're going to go on because we want to get some testimony from some of the stakeholders here today too. So
thank you, Mr. Chair, and Representative Molina. Well, you know, I mean, we're either placing the Department of Health or the program. Something is between the patient and the doctor here, and it kind of strikes me. I mean, we are massaging this into something to make it appear that, you know, somehow this qualifies federally with the law. I don't know if that's true or not. I know that Colorado, you know, outright they're eating in brownies out there and other things. You know, you've got everything across the board. I mean, Colorado has just, you know, made it wide open. I'm not advocating for that, but I'm suggesting that I think they're saying, well, the federal government isn't enforcing this, so we're going to do this, is what it appeared Colorado did. And then on the Senate side, I think their bill does not have this architecture between the patient and the healthcare provider. I don't know. I see $20,000 registration fee for this. And then the other question, I guess maybe I won't ask a question, Mr. Chair, but just comments.
We're trying to get through the bill, and then we were going to sort of circle back if we could, because I should have probably just had Representative Moline do that, but I've been allowing questions as we go through because I really want us to understand it. But
okay. I'll suspend them, Mr.
Okay,
Chair.
Okay, Representative Uglem.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Apologize, I have to leave in a little bit here, so I'd like to jump ahead.
Can you just put your microphone down there so we can
hear? Representative Moline, I like the architecture of this bill, and I like the checks and balances that are in here. Jumping ahead to the end, what's this going to cost the state to implement, and do we have any revenues that are coming in from this, any tax revenues or things like that?
Representative Moline.
Mr. Chair and Representative Uglem, there is a fiscal note. I don't know if it was in your packet or not.
It was passed out.
The Department of Health is estimating 9.5 FTEs in order to administer the program, which ends up being...
It's
$2.8 million. In order for the Department of Health's obligation, the patients who enroll have to pay an enrollment fee into the registry, $200 per patient. But if they're on, or if they qualify for disability or MA or Minnesota Care, then it's a $50 enrollment fee, so a reduced fee. The $20,000 that Representative Drazkowski referenced is an application fee for the manufacturer. And if a manufacturer isn't picked, then they get a $19,000 $19,000 back. That is a similar model of what's in the bill that passed the Senate over there. It was a $15,000 application fee, and they get $14,000 back. So that's to help the department recoup their costs associated with the application of the manufacturer, and then there's also that we were going to get to in the bill some model for the manufacturer to pay fees to the commissioner to cover the regulatory costs.
Representative Uglum.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So the $200 to register and things, I mean, did we do a pro forma so we're going to recover our costs at least on this expensive program, or are we just taking that $200 out of the air?
Representative Moline.
Mr. Chair, the fiscal note is reflective of the fees paid for by the patient and the manufacturer and then what the costs will be to the department in order to implement the program.
One last follow-up. Representative Moline, but do we have any idea how many people are going to be enrolled in this program at $200 a head?
Mr. Chair, Mr. Chair and Representative Uglum, the fiscal note on page 5 estimates that there'll be 5,045 patients enrolled based on what the qualifying conditions are in the bill. The department estimated that about half those people would qualify for the reduced enrollment fee. You know, based on these are serious conditions that many people qualify for things like disability, and so then therefore they would have the reduced enrollment fee. But yes, there's an estimate for how many patients would be enrolled and who would be paying the higher fee and who would be paying the lower fee.
Okay. Thank you, Representative Moline. I'm glad we did our due diligence on this.
Okay. Representative Moline, do you want to continue, please?
Mr. Chair and members, I think I got through most of the patient enrollment. Yeah. The commissioner is also required to enroll the patient in the registry program after receipt of the application and disclosure form, and allows denial of enrollment under certain circumstances, including but not limited to the patient's previous removal from the registry program for violation of the patient's duties. Requires the commissioner to provide written notice to the patient for reason of denial. States denial of enrollment is a final decision that's subject to judicial review. And states that a patient's enrollment may be revoked for a patient's violation of requirement under subdivision 9. Which the subdivision 9 simply requires that the patient as a condition of enrollment continue to receive regularly scheduled treatment for their qualifying medical condition from a healthcare practitioner and report changes in their qualifying medical condition to the healthcare practitioner. Essentially, the patient has to recertify annually that they have a qualifying condition. So, you know, if, for example, you have cancer, but then it goes into remission or you're determined to be cancer-free, then, you know, you don't just have a lifetime enrollment. You have to re-enroll in the program annually based on the fact that you're still determined to have the qualifying condition. The patient is also required to apply or to submit to the commissioner their name, date of birth. They're assigned a registry number. If the patient is a child under the age of 18, the patient's parent or legal guardian provides that information to the commissioner. And the commissioner shall develop the registry verification to provide to the healthcare practitioner identified in the patient's application and to the manufacturer. And also, members, we do have language that there's nothing that requires MA or Minnesota Care to reimburse for costs associated with enrollment in this program or the medicine the patient receives. Just as private health insurance doesn't cover costs associated with medical cannabis either. The healthcare practitioner duties requires the healthcare practitioner prior to patient enrollment in the registry program to determine whether the patient suffers from the qualifying condition. and whether or not that patient has, again, the disability that would prevent them from self-administering the medication. Requires a healthcare practitioner to report health records to the commissioner in accordance with paragraph C, which is the data privacy provisions. I don't know if we want to get into that now. And then the subdivision 8 goes through the manufacturer of medical cannabis duties. Requires a manufacturer to provide a reliable and ongoing supply of medical cannabis for the registry program. Requires all cultivation, harvesting, manufacturing, and packing of cannabis to be in an enclosed, locked facility at the address of the manufacturer provided during the registration process. Requires the manufacturer to produce medical cannabis with the chemical compositions determined by the commissioner. So that goes back to some earlier sections I was talking about where the commissioner provides a range of compositions and a range of dosages that are known to be possibly medically beneficial for those conditions. It requires the manufacturer to contract with a laboratory subject to the commissioner's approval for all testing of the medical cannabis that gets to the third-party independent laboratory to do the testing. Requires the manufacturer to process the cannabis plant into liquid, including oil, pill, or vaporized delivery method using liquid or oil prior to distribution. Requires the manufacturer to require any employee with prior training or experience in the practice of pharmacy to be the only employee to distribute the medical cannabis to the patient. So under this model, members, the patient picks up the medical cannabis from the manufacturer, and that goes to the language we have that it needs to be a pharmacist who provides the cannabis to the patient or to the parent of a patient if the patient is a minor. Requires the manufacturer prior to distribution, among other things, verify the patient's identity and registration in the program, and have the licensed pharmacist determine the dosage for the individual patient, and properly label each product, and ensure distribution is only for a 30-day supply of the dosage. We also have language in the bill that requires the manufacturer to deliver medical cannabis to a patient who is one that has been determined to need a designated caregiver. So again, the scenario where a patient is unable to administer medicine to themselves or unable to leave their home because they're on hospice or they have other debilitating condition that would prevent them from picking up the medicine, allows for a mechanism to have the medicine delivered to their residents. Requires the manufacturer to submit a monthly report to the commissioner containing information, among other things, the amount and dosages distributed and the chemical composition of the medicine administered. Prohibits the manufacturer from having a financial relationship with a healthcare practitioner. Prohibits the manufacturer from allowing a person to consume cannabis on site. States that the manufacturer is subject to reasonable inspection by the Commissioner of Health. And states that for the purposes of this section, the manufacturer is not subject to Board of Pharmacy licensure regulations. And members, on page 10, subdivision 9, the patient duties, this is just that requires a patient to apply to the commissioner for enrollment in the registry program and to pay the annual fee that we discussed earlier. Requires, again, that the patient continue to receive regularly scheduled treatment for their qualifying condition. And report any changes in their qualifying condition to their healthcare practitioner. Subdivision 10, confidentiality, classifies data in patient files with the healthcare practitioner and the commissioner and data submitted to or by the medical cannabis manufacturer's private or non-public data is defined in section 13.02. Also precludes the commissioner from using data for any purposes not listed in section 152.22 and precludes data from being combined or linked in any manner with other lists or databases. The subdivision 11 protections for registry program participation against criminal and civil liability. It states that there's a presumption that no patient who's enrolled in the registry program is engaged in unauthorized use of medical cannabis. States that the presumption of authorized use may be rebutted by evidence that the patient's conduct related to use was not for the purpose of treating or alleviating the qualifying condition. And then states that the following are not violations under Chapter 152, which are the drug enforcement laws. What wouldn't be a violation is use or possession of medical cannabis products by a patient or possession by the parent or guardian of the patient under 18, possession of medical cannabis products by a registered designated caregiver, possession, dosage, administration, and dispensing medical cannabis by the manufacturer or employees of the manufacturer, possession of medical cannabis products by a person while carrying out the duties required under this section.
So, Representative Lincoln, just a quick question here. So, if I was using medical marijuana, would I have a card that specified that I was in this legally enrolled in this program?
Mr. Chair, the language discussed earlier is the label on the medical cannabis product that identifies the patient, date of birth, and their registry number. We don't require a card for the patient to be carrying around.
So the product itself would be labeled with the person's right. name on it. Okay, very good. Thank you.
Precludes the commissioner, the commissioner's staff, or any healthcare practitioner from being subject to civil or disciplinary penalties by a business, occupational, or professional licensing board. States that the commissioner or employees of a state agency may not be held civilly or criminally liable for any actor for a certain occurrence caused by any act or omission while acting within the scope of office or employment under this section. Subdivision 2, discrimination prohibited, prohibits a school or landlord from refusing to enroll or lease to a person based on the person's status as a patient. Unless failing to do so would violate federal law or regulation or cause a school or landlord to lose monetary or licensing-related benefits. States that the use of medical cannabis is considered an unauthorized use of a medication and does not constitute the use of illicit substance for the purpose of medical care, including organ transplants, and then prohibits the employer from discrimination in hiring, termination, or other terms of employment. So we know that a lot of employers obviously require drug testing of employees. This is saying they can't be discriminated against based on their patient enrollment in the registry program, although we do have other language where they can't use the medicine on the premises of the employer and can obviously not be impaired at work. Prohibits denial of custody, visitation rights, or parenting time based on a person's status as a patient in the registry program. Subdivision 13 is the fees that we already covered, paid for by the patient. Subdivision 14, nursing facilities, allows nursing facilities or boarding care homes to adopt reasonable restrictions on the use of medical cannabis by persons receiving inpatient services. The drug formulary language just adds medical cannabis to drug formulary. The revolving fund is what I spoke to a little bit earlier, which just creates Department of Health revolving fund for purposes of carrying out the commissioner's responsibilities under section 152.22 and requires the manufacturer to pay the revolving fund the per diem salaries for the inspection and audits by the commissioner. And then, members, the impact assessment task force is a task force put together of 23 members that are required to report back to the legislature. And the task force is consists of...
Yeah, we see all of them. We see that.
You don't need me to go through all of
them? No,
those.
No.
Okay.
Pretty standard language.
I think we're getting close to the end here. So this is, so if you can sort of wrap up here, suddenly.
Oh, well, I think that basically concludes it. It's just the task force is required to submit reports to the legislative committees on public safety, human services, judiciary, and civil law.
Okay. I'm going to take Representative Nelson. Then what I'd like to do is I do want to hear from law enforcement, and I'd like to hear from the some of the families maybe first, because they have children, and if they would like to leave, maybe we could have them testify first if anyone wants to. But Representative Nelson, you had a question.
I may not have to ask any more questions about this, but the task force you're setting this up. I know Representative Pepin, who stepped out, there's no expiration date on the task force. I know some people in the legislature like to have these come back to be relooked at from time to time. And I guess what is your reasoning for having no expiration date? Sometimes we'll set these up for 5 years and then come back and reauthorize them for another 5 years. So there's a sunset on them. And this is set up with no expiration date. So... what you're thinking there, I guess, is the question I'm asking. And I'm asking.
Mr. Chair and Representative Nelson, I guess there's no expiration date on the bill. It's an ongoing program. We do only require the task force to report back by every 2 years after the implementation of the program in February of 2015. Again, I think it's set up like that just because the program doesn't end, the patient registry doesn't end, but I'm not opposed to sunsetting task forces. That's what you're asking.
Well, I'm just trying. I know the point's probably going to come up, so I'm kind of, because Representative Pepin is quite passionate about that, and so you just so you're aware of that, and more so, I can understand why this would be an ongoing task force, but there are people that like these to have a time certain when they end and have to come back and be reauthorized.
Representative Neuberger, then let's take some testimony.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Moline, this is the first chance I've had to read this as well, so bear with me. I'm a medical person. So when I first looked at this bill, in the title it says a medical cannabis therapeutic research study. So immediately the medical professional in me said, okay, there's a starting point and an ending point and an evaluation period, and then we're going to determine whether or not this works. That's what a study is in its basic boiled down form. As you were just saying here, though, you're saying that this program doesn't end. So I think there needs to be some clarification to what we're calling this. If it's an ongoing study, I understand that parameter as well. But if it's an ongoing study, then as I go, I'm looking at this purely through medical eyes. I'm not looking at this through public safety or any other. I'm just looking at this as a medical provider. If this works, then we need to address that. As I look at your task force, there's only four of the members are healthcare providers. I think if we're going to be using, you know, compounds, THC derivatives, that there needs to be more than four members of the healthcare community. There needs to be more physicians on here, in my opinion. So I'm calling attention to some gray areas here. We're calling this a study, but yet the program doesn't end. I'd really like to see some clarification before this hits the floor. And then the other thing I'm just going to wrap up here on is on line 4-3 to 4-9. Representative Moline, the language here says the commissioner shall make An initial determination by the 1st of December of 14, after reviewing medical and scientific literature and the range of chemical compositions of any plant of the genus cannabis that will likely be medically beneficial to each of the qualifying conditions, including a range of recommended doses for each condition. Once determined, the commissioner shall provide a listing of the range of chemical compositions and the range of dosages to the manufacturer and publish the listing on the department website. Representative Moline, that's an enormous study. What you're asking the commissioner to do here is, that's enormous. I think it's a good thing. What you're telling the commissioner to do here, I think, is appropriate. But in our haste to rush this through, and I'm not being sarcastic, okay, I'm not. I look at this one section of the bill, and that is just, if you look at all of the qualifying conditions, and the final qualifying condition is any other condition that is treatment that's approved by the commissioner. Representative Moline, I think we need to address the fact that you're asking the commissioner's office to do an enormous amount of work, and we need to make sure that we've got our eyes wide open as we go into this. So is this a study or is this a program? And if we're going to tell the commissioner to come up with these different results for all this myriad of different doses and side effects and benefits and all this other stuff, I'd like to know how this is going to happen.
Representative Moline.
Thank
you. Mr. Chair, that's reflected in the fiscal note. I mean, I've had several conversations with the Department of Health. Obviously, they'll be consulting with experts in order to determine what those qualifying, what's medically beneficial for those qualifying conditions. But they didn't indicate to me that that was a task that they would be unable to undertake.
Okay, Representative Neuberger, if you have some ideas for amendments too, again, I would encourage you to get those drafted.
Thank you.
Okay, thank you. At this point, are there any family members who came down who would like to testify? I know it's appreciate you coming down. If you could maybe keep your comments to a few minutes, that would be good. So. If you could introduce yourself for the record, too, please.
Thank you, Mr. Chairs and Committee. My name is Angie Weaver, and this is my 8-year-old daughter, Amelia Weaver. Thank you for all taking the time tonight to listen to this very important issue to my family and I. I will be brief because my daughter has been here since 8 a.m. this morning, and she is also ready to go. Amelia has Dravet syndrome. It is a rare, catastrophic form of epilepsy. What that means for our family and Amelia. We have been at the doctor's office since she's 18 months old. Amelia has tried and failed 23 anticonvulsants with side effects from liver damage, brittle bones, nausea, vomiting, sleeplessness, on and on and on, and always the seizures. We have tried what is out there. Getting this diagnosis was devastating to my family. The only thing that gave us hope was watching the story of a little girl named Charlotte Figge. Her mom actually came and testified here last week, Paige Figge. She's a little girl in Colorado with my daughter's same exact diagnosis, Dravet syndrome. Because Charlotte lives in Colorado, have her medicine, which is CBD oil. She takes this CBD oil in a dropper or with her food, and she is gaining seizure control. She is, like my daughter's been nonverbal since she was 4 years old. Charlotte's starting to talk again. She's starting to have quality of life. Amelia right now has 30 to 50 seizures a day. Since we've been here today, she's probably had at least 50. In the aisles and sitting here, she's had 4 grand mal seizures. Otherwise, typically Amelia has drops. what my family has been fighting for since this winter, before that we even got into session, we were meeting with legislators telling our story, is Amelia doesn't have time to wait. Children with Dravet syndrome die all the time. Hard to even say it. I don't want to lose my daughter. We have no other options. She needs this. And because she lives in the state of Minnesota, she should not be denied this medicine. We are out of time. We fought as hard as we can, and I'm just asking you to please open your minds and listen to the testimonies of the people that are here. Jeremy Pauling was here tonight. He actually got called away. He couldn't finish testifying. His daughter, Caitlin, has Batten's disease, and she is terminal. Caitlin doesn't have time to wait for this. I guess that's all I have to say. I can answer any questions that anyone would have for us as well.
Are there any questions of Ms. Weaver? Ms. Weaver, thank you for testimony and for being here all day today, too.
Yeah.
Anyone else that would like to testify?
Mr. Chair, I just wanted to add briefly for members, a lot of these testifiers have spent just about as much time at the Capitol this year as we have, so sometimes they forget to explain sort of the basics of how the medicine is administered, and for these kids specifically, it's turned into an oil form and administered orally to the child, just as many other medications that we're familiar with would be administered to children. This Charlotte's Web strain that Ms. Weaver mentioned, kids are seeing 85 to 99% seizure reduction. And not only that, they're actually regaining a lot of their cognitive skills that they've lost due to damage caused by seizures. So some pretty tremendous results. But I just wanted to add, for informational purposes for the committee, that that's how that medication is delivered to children.
Thank you. Welcome. Please introduce yourself.
Good evening, Mr. Chair and committee members. My name is Martha Schultz. My older sister, Maria, would be here to testify this evening, but she is currently living in Colorado with her 7-year-old daughter, my niece, Greta. They're living there in order to legally access Charlotte's Web, which is a safe and legal liquid form of medical cannabis that Greta takes mixed in with her food 3 times a day. This medical cannabis has been such a miracle for Greta, but since it is not legal in the state of Minnesota, their family made the tough decision to move Greta and Maria to Colorado while Greta's father, Mark, and 2 older sisters, Emma and Laura, ages 13 and 10, continue to live at home on their family farm in Clinton, Minnesota. Greta started seizing at 5 months of age, was diagnosed with infantile spasms at 7 months, and her condition has further deteriorated into a Lennox-Gastaut syndrome, which is a severe form of epilepsy in which Greta has to endure multiple types of seizures each day and also has severe developmental delay. Mark and Maria have done everything they possibly can to help control Greta's epilepsy over the past 7 years. To date, Greta has failed over 15 epilepsy medications, 2 strict specialized diets, and even brain surgery. This past summer, after much research and prayer, Mark, Maria, Emma, and Laura made the decision that moving part of their family to Colorado was necessary in order to give Greta her greatest shot at seizure freedom. Greta's longtime epilepsy physician from St. Paul even supported them going to Colorado, as he knew that Greta had run out of options to treat her epilepsy. So they went to Colorado, purchased a home there, went through the rigorous process of getting Greta approved for medical cannabis, and were finally able to start Charlotte's Web on November 12, 2013. Since starting medical cannabis, Greta has enjoyed nearly an 80% decrease in her seizure activity, has been able to get off 3 of the 5 pharmaceuticals that she was taking, and most importantly, started doing things that she's never done before, such as being able to hold a spoon and bring it to her mouth. Greta's teachers in Colorado have been so impressed with her progress that they've increased her time in the mainstream classroom each day at school. We're also super excited that she recently started giving kisses again. I am a parent of 2 children, healthy, and I could not imagine not having being able to getting kisses or hugs from my child for the last 10 years or 7 years. But now Greta has regained that ability to give kisses again, an ability that her epilepsy and her medications have taken from her over 3 years ago, but that's back. Such amazing progress has been made with medical cannabis Greta is taking. So why in the world can't this family be back together and be able to give Greta the medicine she needs while in the comforts of her home with her family around her here in Minnesota? Bringing the cannabis back to Minnesota would risk federal felony conviction, child endangerment, and a Minnesota state misdemeanor conviction. Maria would also risk losing her master's and bachelor's license in nursing, in addition to possibly losing access to Charlotte's Web, which is the only treatment that has helped decrease Greta's seizures. The risk is just too great. Greta absolutely adores being with her family, especially her sisters, and this is something she's only been able to do 18 out of the last 170 days since she has been away from home. Maria and Greta are not only separated from Mark, Emma, and Laura, but also from grandparents, aunts and uncles, cousins, and lots of friends back in their community. It would be illegal for her to come back to Minnesota, even if it was only for a short time. This is just not right, and it's just not fair. The medical cannabis that Greta is taking in Colorado does not and would never give anyone of a high because of the extremely low amount of THC that is in the cannabis she takes. It is safer than any of the prescription medicines that she has been on over the past 7 years. But they can't legally bring it back home or even access it in their home state of Minnesota. The best medical treatment that Greta has ever had, and it's illegal in our state. It's unfair and it's wrong. You have been elected to serve the people of this great state of Minnesota, and you have the power to help change today this law in Minnesota. For our family's sake and for the sake of so many others who are suffering, please, please pass this bill today and help bring Greta and Maria back home. Thank you for your time and your consideration. And just in closing here, I just have a couple of pictures. This is actually Greta. This was taken on one of her better days. Greta is also nonverbal, just like Amelia is, dependent with 24/7 care. This is their picture of their entire family that's been separated by Maria and Greta being in Colorado for the last 4 or 5 months, being over 800 miles apart. It's time to bring them home, and it's time to have Greta get access to this medication safe and legal in her home.
Thank you.
Any questions?
Sorry. Any questions of Ms. Schultz? Representative Liebling?
First of all, thank you for being here and
sure. Sticking
it out and
You're
everything.
Welcome. Thank you.
I just wonder if you, having been listening to the explanation of the bill that's before us, if you have any comments on the particular way that this is being proposed right now. I mean, I think we all know that you want this to be available, but anything related to this?
To be perfectly honest with you, I have not personally reviewed the bill word for word. I know my sister in Colorado has reviewed it. It's been just a little bit of a crazy day going from session to session to committee meeting to committee meeting, and my phone is actually dead, so I can't actually give you the answer on that one because I honestly have not had the time to read the bill. I am 100% in favor of whatever we can do to give access to kids, to adults, to give them a better quality of life.
Thank you for your testimony, Ms. Schultz.
Yeah.
Next, if you could keep your comments to about 3 minutes so we can accommodate everybody else that we need to hear from.
Hi. My name is Janessa Lee, and I'm a resident of North St. Paul, Minnesota. I'm a 27-year-old mother to a beautiful 7-year-old little girl named Reagan. Reagan and I have a genetic illness called Ehlers-Danlos syndrome, or EDS for short. I have as well been diagnosed with the following secondary illnesses: generalized hypermobility of joints, joint pain, arthritis in multiple sites, osteoarthritis in multiple sites, myopia, vitreous degeneration of the eyes, variant migraines, muscle weakness, neuropathy, vitamin D deficiency, Raynaud's phenomenon, degenerative disc disease, depression, and anxiety. EDS has a great impact on our muscle skeletal system, digestive system, urinary system, has heart involvement, as well as neurological symptoms. The reason it is so widespread is because we have a defect in our collagen. Collagen is 90% of your body. It helps tissue resist deformation. Collagen is an important contributor to the physical strengths of skin, joints, muscles, ligaments, blood vessels, and visceral organs. Abnormal collagen renders these structures more elastic and therefore weak. Depending on the individual, the severity of the mutation can vary from mild to life-threatening, and there is no cure. Imagine a life where your joints are constantly popping in and out, yes, dislocating, sublocating, and hyperextending, and every step I take, my knees are 15 degrees past the point they're supposed to. My ankles, wrists, fingers, SI joints, neck, elbows, shoulders also hyperextend, subluxate, and dislocate daily. For myself and other EDS patients, this is our reality. As you can imagine, the simplest of tasks become not so simple. This is a very debilitating syndrome, and I have lost the ability to learn to earn a living due to my illness. I had lost hope for many years and didn't care if I lived or died. I was in so much pain. Cannabis is the only way I manage my illness and pain because I will not subject my body to the harms of taking narcotic pain medicine. No one can realistically live a good quality of life being on long-term and high-dose narcotics, in my opinion and my life experience. The decision to only medicate with cannabis was one of the best decisions I made for myself. Cannabis alleviates pain. It is an antioxidant, anti-inflammatory, neuroprotective, and a neuroprotective. Cannabis helps in many health issues that stem from EDS and help control pain. It really is a win-win situation. I need to have safe and non-criminal access to medical cannabis, which includes being able to safely grow my own medicine. Cannabis cultivation was in the bill and was the sole means and only way for indigent Minnesota patients and their caregivers to medicate in medical need of cannabis, an easy way to afford the medicine that we need to stay alive. Federal law prevents coverage of cannabis through Medicaid, Minnesota Care, and Minnesota Assistance, or MinCare and Medical Assistance, and patients receiving $400 to $957 a month on disability cannot afford $250 to $500 a month in medical cannabis. The cannabis cultivation was removed from legislation, and it's a little disheartening, as I wouldn't be able to afford my medication, but it would be legal for me to get. Frustrating. I would hate to see all the hard work and efforts leave out a vast majority who would be legally allowed to buy cannabis, but for financial restrictions, cultivation restrictions, and lack of insurance coverage would just cause more pain and stress. Pain, disease, and illness do not discriminate by income. Unfortunately, becoming ill is unpredictable and extremely stressful. My health conditions are already so stressful and exhausting. Do we really need to cause more pain and frustration to those who are suffering? I ask you, please, add Ehlers-Danlos syndrome to the qualifying list of illnesses that are covered under this bill so we are protected patients, as well as the ability to cultivate and grow our own medicine. I understand people's concern for cultivation in your own home, but I believe that we can come to a compromise on this, like other states have. I know that I wouldn't jeopardize my lifeline, that is cannabis, to try to grow mass quantities to distribute. The sick also do not have the time or energy it would take to even do that. I know I don't. We only want a better quality of life. We're not trying to make a quick buck. Please see that we are sick patients, not criminals looking to gain profit. Cannabis has given me hope. When I medicate, I have a quality of life worth living. I cannot emphasize how much cannabis has helped save my life. It's given me hope as I can enjoy life again. I am in much less pain. Please do not let this bill pass without adding Ehlers-Danlos syndrome to the qualifying conditions, as well as cultivating our own medications, or our own medicine. Also, May is Ehlers-Danlos syndrome awareness month that was signed by Governor Dayton himself. I thank you for hearing me and taking my testimony today.
Thank you very much for your testimony. Any questions? Ms. Lesh.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. And Ms. Lee, if you could, offline or somehow submit whatever you can to me, because it would be my intention to offer that as amendment on the floor so that is included, and hopefully it will gain the acceptance of the House.
Thank you so much.
Thank you for your testimony.
Thank you.
Anybody else? Rich, can you just hold? I was trying to get from the families here, if there's anyone, any of the families. Okay, Representative Nelson had a question. If there isn't anybody else, thank you all for coming down and showing your support. Representative Nelson, did you have a question before we get to?
My question has to do with the rulemaking, Representative Moline. And the rulemaking process, and in your testimony you spoke about, there's not going to be smoking in this bill. And again, this I'm channeling Representative Pepin because she mentioned this to me earlier today. But you also said that the commissioner would be able to, the current delivery methods that are in the bill, plus he'd be able to add other ones in the future. And I guess the concern I have that was expressed to me was about, would he be able to add smoking through the rulemaking process to this bill?
Representative Moline.
Mr. Chair and Chair Nelson, no, it says on line 1.20, any other method approved by the commissioner but which shall not include smoking.
Thank you, Representative Moline. I just need to make sure we had that on the record.
Okay, before law enforcement comes down, are there any other... Mr. Neumeister, do you want to make a brief comment?
Mr. Chairman?
No, I'm just trying to get sort of the citizens, and then we'll have law enforcement come down.
Mr. Chairman, members of the Joint Committee, my name is Rich Neumeister. I'm going to comment on some of the data issues and just a couple observations.
Okay, Mr. Neumeister, I wonder if you can wait, because we're going to do the data component of the bill in a few minutes. If you could just hold your comments, and then I want to get the criminal stuff done now, if you wouldn't mind, unless you have to leave.
I do have to leave.
All right, then go ahead.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, thank you for the few moments. I'd just like to be able to say, Mr. Chairman, it's great to see other citizens, other people be persistent and to make policy change. As someone who's done all that, my kudos and hats to the family members who are continuously doing their efforts. Secondly, Mr. Chairman, with the marijuana issue before the legislature, I looked at some information on the internet, some on computer these days. In 1970, the great, great majority of people opposed any kind of marijuana legalization for medical or whatever. Times are changing. And so with the bill before you, you have to decide for the majority of Minnesotans do want something. So is something better than nothing? Yes, something is better than nothing. Because one of the things that I have learned, and you as policymakers have learned, and the family members who have learned, and other people on this issue, you can always come back and build on something. So if you're going to pass something, this body, I think it's important to address some issues that are very important that sometimes don't get the attention, is on the data issues. So if you look on page 8, 87 and 88, the Tennyson warning is a very important item, particularly on this kind of situation, because information will be shared in different kinds of situations. And still, as we all know, there is a negative about medical marijuana, marijuana usage, or anything with the word marijuana. So I think it's very important to protect those people who come in these things. The Tennyson warning is going to be an important item so people know where their kind of information will be used. The other item is on 820.144.291, which is our Health Records Act. There's a lot. It's like Swiss cheese in certain situations. It can be shared with a number of entities. So I think it's important that you get an idea, like a flow chart or whatever, for people who participate in this kind of program, where that information goes. Mr. Chairman, maybe some of the old-timers, I don't know if there are any on your committee who have been around since about 1980, 82, in the early 80s, but there was a whole big issue about people peddling marijuana, doing marijuana stuff, but the state wanted to get its cut. So what they did, they said, we're going to have a Marijuana Stamp Tax Act. So you can do illegal stuff with marijuana, but the state wants to get its cut. So you go down to the Department of Revenue, you pay so much, or whatever. Well, there's a state statute that's been around for nearly 30 years that protects the privacy of aspects of that. And I think that is a good model, to at least not word for word, but to look at the concept, because it comes from the view that there's immunity in certain things. And some of the immunities are addressed here in discrimination, jobs, things like that. But then maybe take that kind of concept and build in the exceptions as to who should have the data. Now, one of the other important things that I believe in is, you know, the issue about law enforcement and their access to this kind of data. I think there should be some strong protections the best you can. The Stamp Act is one thing that deals with that issue as an idea, or you can also have basically a search warrant kind of thing. So there are different approaches that you can do. And it's going to take a little bit of work because you want to make sure that people that participate in this program are not stigmatized or hit on or whatever because of the urgent need that folks need this kind of stuff. So, Mr. Chairman, I just encourage something is better than nothing. All the folks that want more can always come back next year, as I've been doing for a great many years and built on many laws that I just started out with. And it's taken a few years to get better laws for the state of Minnesota. You start with something. Thank you.
Thank you for testimony, Mr. Newmaster. I'd like to now, we have not heard from the law enforcement community. This is the chair of the Public Safety Committee, and our committee is curious about your reaction and your thoughts on the bill as it is now. And I'm going to ask you to come down somewhat from law enforcement and from the county attorney's office. Mr. Flaherty. Mr. Kingray, thank you for coming down and this evening. You just pull up another chair there, maybe. This is a new iteration of the bill. And so we'd like to hear your reaction to it. Mr. Flaherty.
Mr. Chairman, for the record, Dennis Flaherty. I'm Executive Director of the Minnesota Police and Peace Officers Association.
Very good. Welcome. Can you tell us your impressions of the bill? I, at least from the press, it sounds like you're neutral, but we'd like to, you know, our committee has not had the opportunity. We're hearing the bill now.
Well, Mr. Chair, in its present form, I think it's safe to say that as a coalition, we do not oppose this bill. It incorporates a number of things that we actually had discussed with Representative Moline back in very early March. And we actually are intrigued by the idea of the use of the extracts of marijuana. We were very concerned about smoking, multiple sites to purchase marijuana throughout the state. And to her credit, she has incorporated a number of the things that we had talked about. So I think it's safe to say we do not oppose her bill as it is drafted this evening.
Questions of Mr. Flaherty? Representative Lush.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Ms. Flaherty, I may have some other questions, but for now, what is law enforcement's? Does law enforcement object to allowing individuals to smoke it?
Mr. Flaherty,
Mr. Chair, and Representative Lesh, we do oppose that.
Okay.
And Mr. Chair, Mr. Flaherty, I can't figure out why law enforcement would take a position on the method by which the medicine is taken. Can you explain that to me?
Mr. Flaherty.
Well, Representative Lesh, I guess I could just summarize it by saying we do not see smoking marijuana or the use of marijuana as a... We don't see it as a harmless substance. Instead, we see it as one that has been pointed out a couple times tonight is in violation of federal law. We see it as a drug that, if used on a regular basis, can lead to addiction and lead to a whole host of other problems that I know you're well aware of once addicted. We are guided by recent strong resolution by the National Association of Drug Court Administrators, who, and I'd encourage you to go on their website, who cited pretty clearly and strongly that, and as you know, they see severely addicted people that are on meth and heroin and cocaine and have long, long criminal histories, and in each and every case, it started with the use of marijuana. And so during this process, we became aware of the use of the extracts from the plant, and we became intrigued by that. And obviously, if there's hope for sick people, and particularly children, that's why we had that conversation with Representative Moline.
Okay, well, Mr. Chair.
Representative Blash.
Thank you for that answer, Mr. Flaherty. And, I see in my mind there are probably all kinds of legitimate reasons of, at least under the banner of law enforcement, I'm trying to think about, a person like me who would prefer to keep a medicine like this, if it's possible for application in a natural method, to not run it through pharmaceutical industry. I'm sure the pharmaceutical industry would have opinions on that. Law enforcement, I'm sure, for certain control reasons, would have opinions about, where it's grown or manufactured because of the ability to effectively enforce the laws. But I guess I'm still a little lost, or I don't understand why law enforcement cares whether someone smokes it or not, unless there was some evidence that you've seen. And, of course, I would expect the medical profession to testify on this, that somehow it is more addictive if it is smoked than if it's applied with an oil or something. But I think you've given a full answer on that. So.
Before we take more questions, there's two more members that have questions. Mr. Kingrey, do you want to just provide some brief testimony as to what the County Attorney's Association's position on the revised Moline bill is?
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, John Kingrey speaking on behalf of the Minnesota County Attorneys Association. First of all, our thoughts and our hearts and prayers go out to the families that are afflicted by this, in which there's the promise that some medicinal form of marijuana may provide them some relief. Like many of you around the table, I'm the father of a couple of children, and I can't imagine the grief that they are going through. And if we can, through good, rigorous clinical trials, prove that this does provide the relief that it may appear to resolve, then we need to move forward. I think one of the changes in 2009, Representative Lesh, I remember a couple of days ago in rules, you talked about your travels in terms of how you've progressed in your thinking on marijuana. And sort of like you, back in 2009, you maybe a little bit earlier, 2007, the individuals that I've worked with on this issue, the Law Enforcement Coalition, have just said no. This year they have moved off of that. They moved off of that because of some of the anecdotal information that we have seen, and that's why we have indicated support for clinical study, the issuance of any medical marijuana in a pill or gel form. And when the revised bill was introduced midweek last week, I did send it out to all 87 elected county attorneys, and I received about 8 or 9 responses. They were positive, and I received no negative responses from any of my members with regard to the bill that was rolled out last week. This, I think, is more clear. I think it's tighter, and I believe moves us in a direction that is clearly consistent with the position that my association has taken over the years, as well as the law enforcement individuals that we've worked with on this issue.
So the position of the County Attorneys Association is? Formal position of the
position is, Mr. Chairman and members of the committee, is that it's consistent with what we have put out there. We have not taken a formal vote of our board, but do not oppose the bill in its current form. And again, the bill, I think, it's quite frankly, sometimes it's almost changing hourly. It's sort of hard to keep track of the amendments that have taken place. But it is consistent with what we have articulated both in testimony and last week in the Minneapolis Star Tribune.
Very good. Thank you. Representative Liebling and then Druskowski.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I'm just curious from each of you, when we talk about the bill in its current form, obviously this bill could likely change on the floor. And I think we just saw a Senate debate where there were lots of amendments offered. I don't know how many were actually adopted, but I want to talk about the issue of how many dispensaries there would be or manufacturers. So I understand 55 seems like a bridge too far. Maybe that is a legitimate law enforcement issue, although I'm sure you probably know my opinion is that sometimes or law enforcement generally, organized law enforcement has been giving opinions upon which you shouldn't be opining because the medical issues, I think, are out of your area. But I grant you that the enforcement of whatever we pass will be in your folks' area. So I want to know how many dispensaries, you know, where the line is for you on the number of dispensaries. So this bill has one. I think a lot of us might believe that one is not enough, that is really creates some problems from lack of competition and lack of choice, and if one goes out of business, then there's none, and so on. So, you know, I want to ask, what if there were, say, five in different areas of the state? Is that a deal killer for you?
Mr. Chair and Representative, we have talked really because of the need for the Commissioner of Health to be able to regulate this, and in terms of growing marijuana properly, making sure that it's grown correctly and that it contains no or low levels of THC, this is a tremendous responsibility, and we are quite content with one location, because it's not only going to be dispensed out of there, but it's going to be grown out of there. So that would be the most desirable position for security reasons and for just overall regulatory reasons.
Representative.
All right. Well, thank you, Mr. Flaherty. And I kind of think that the Commissioner of Health could speak for himself on what he's able to do. I'm not really interested in your opinion on what he's able to do. I'm interested in your opinion on what law enforcement is able to do, because obviously that would be in your members' bailiwick. So, you know, are you saying that you wouldn't support a bill, or you would oppose a bill that had more than one? I want to be really clear about this, because I think it's very likely that there will be amendments to increase the number. And I sincerely want this to be a workable law when it passes. And enforcement is going to be part of that. So I want to know, is it practical to enforce the law if you had five?
Mr. Flaherty.
Mr. Chair and Representative Lee, I think our position this evening is what it's been all along. One is our preference.
Representative Liebling, I suspect that there'll be amendments also. This came up in Ways and Means today, because Representative Moline didn't want to mess up the bill until we had a chance to vet all of this. It was pretty clear from the voice vote anyway that the majority of the Ways and Means Committee looked at maybe having six or more with the same kinds of safeguards that would be for the one that would be located somewhere centrally in the Twin Cities, for instance. So it's more of a fairness issue that should someone have to drive in to St. Paul or Minneapolis every month to get their medicine from northeastern Minnesota when people living here could easily get their medicine. So that was the issue. So I do suspect it would it's going to come up again, Mr. Flair, and I hope you would keep an open mind to some possible alternatives that still provided all the safeguards that are in place. Representative Drazkowski.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I would be remiss not to thank Representative Moline for her work on this bill. Like Mr. Flaherty, I was also intrigued, and I know that Representative Gruenhagen had introduced these ideas similar and maybe actually was talking with Representative Moline about these several weeks ago. And, you know, the idea of having the control around a liquid, a pill, and vapor that you can label the way you've got it in the bill, Representative Moline, I think that's the type of control that we're looking for. And I had the same hesitations that law enforcement did around this. But item number four there, Mr. Flaherty and Mr. Kingery, we basically give the commissioner carte blanche to develop additional methods of delivery. I mean, they're putting them in children's candy in Colorado. And that's not smoking. So, I don't know. I'm comfortable with 1, 2, and 3, but I mean, what does law enforcement think about that open-ended segment there? I struggle with that.
Mr. Chair, Representative Drazkowski, this is the provision where, first of all, I can't imagine the Commissioner of Health approving candy, medical cannabis, but aside from that, this is the provision that we set up similar to the sentencing guidelines approach, where the commissioner would have to notify the legislative chairs of particular committees that he or she planned to adopt a new method, and then the legislature has an opportunity to act if the legislature determines that that's not an appropriate method to allow for the delivery of the medical marijuana. Representative Drazkowski, you know, from what I'm told, technology is obviously always changing, and we never know what the most effective delivery method is. And so allowing some flexibility for down the road when somebody patents a patch or something to deliver the medicine, that the commissioner would have the opportunity to approve something like that.
Representative Drazkowski.
Mr. Chair, I don't know. I haven't heard from the law enforcement and county attorneys, but you know, the legislature, Representative Moline, meets every year, and kind of along the lines of, do we have one facility or 5 or 55? You know, the legislature, I'm sure, will look at this every year or every other year, or there will be different pressures. I just struggle with the idea of leaving something open-ended like that, especially when we're just getting started. But law enforcement and commissioner or attorneys have any ideas or thoughts around that item?
Mr. Kingery.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Drazkowski, now are you talking about the delivery method and the conditions or the number of facilities?
Representative Drazkowski.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Line 1.20 and 1.21 in the bill.
That's what I thought, yeah. Mr. Chairman, Representative Drazkowski, as Representative Moline said, this is very much like the way the sentencing guidelines works, where every year they said, I'm just repeating what she just said, they submit a report to the legislature on changes to the guidelines, and if the legislature does nothing, they become effective next August 1st. So you sort of have a veto on any changes to the sentencing guidelines grid. As I understand this, this is pretty much the way that would work as well, and it's worked, I think, quite well for a number of years.
Representative Schoen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I don't know, did we have other folks that were going to come down and testify?
Well, we can. The public safety part of this committee, I wanted law enforcement.
Well, let me throw some of these things out there, Mr. Chair.
Okay.
I want to address maybe the delivery method. And I think it's important to note that you can bring your kid into the emergency room right now and get a Schedule II sucker. It's called fentanyl. And so those delivery methods may be developed in the future that are necessary for a child. And I think it's important to let the Commissioner of Health do those types of things as they see fit. And, of course, under acceptable science, I understand that. I'm curious, because a lot of this, and I will say from my perspective, is we've had the boogeyman in the closet for so long, and I understand that the criminal enterprise has been fueled by the illicit drug trade for so long that we are completely scared and freaked by the idea of medicine. But you can go to the doctor right now, and cocaine can be used medicinally for procedures. I'm curious if we know or have record currently, and I apologize for putting somebody from the commissioner's office on spot related to their drug task forces. How much do we know of medicinal cocaine in the state of Minnesota is diverted? Or how much, and I'd even go back, does anybody remember when they said it was okay to use cocaine for medicinal purposes, and was there a lot of protest and issues related to that? And if that question is not able to be answered, I understand that, because that probably is pretty difficult to answer.
Did you want someone from the department?
It's not necessary. I actually think it's going to be pretty hard to track. So I will accept that it is. Representative Moline, Mr. Chair, Representative Moline.
Representative Sean.
There is a federal facility that right now there are still patients that are enrolled in a federal marijuana treatment program. Is that correct? There's still patients that receive marijuana from the federal government as medication?
Representative Moline.
Mr. Chair, Representative Schoen, from my understanding of it, there's a federal marijuana grow facility in, I believe it's the state of Mississippi. And, you know, don't quote me on the history of the case law, but I believe what happened was there were a number of patients, glaucoma patients, being treated with marijuana in the 70s or 60s. And then when the federal government rescheduled it to a Schedule I drug, their source of medicine was cut off. And there was a federal court ruling where the federal court said that they could not be denied their medicine. And so because of that, the federal government has since been growing marijuana and sending it to those patients. From my understanding, there's still 4 patients alive and enrolled in that program, and they get their marijuana from the federal government on a monthly basis to treat their symptoms.
Representative Sean.
Mr. Chair, Representative Moline, and I don't know if there's anybody in the room that can answer this question. Do we know of a lot of problems with that facility that grows this in Mississippi?
Representative Moline.
Mr. Chair, Representative Schoen, I'm not aware of any like public safety concerns or problems in that regard. I think the only problem with it is it's difficult for people to get access at all to that medicine, but I'm not aware of any problems with it.
Representative Schoen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. You know, I guess I think Representative Hansen maybe hinted on a couple things, but I'm a little not put back, but I understand. First off, I want to say that Representative Moline has worked very hard on this and has received heat from advocates and detractors of the bill, some certainly very untoward. I think that she's worked very hard with folks to come up with something that maybe that we can get past the legislature, and I think that there's been some misunderstanding of the actual votes that we can get this bill passed off the floor of the House. And I realize that the Senate, as we were sitting in here, did pass a bill with a veto-proof majority of votes. I don't know that we had that in the House, and I thank you for the effort that you put into this, because I know it's been quite a toll on you. I hope that this body can look back at intractable pain that came out of this bill. And I am not advocating for ankle pain, and I don't advocate for California sham type legislation, because I do believe that's what California legislation is. But we have worked hard to make this the toughest and most strict language in the country. And I have said from the beginning that there is no reason, and we sat in the offices together, that there is no reason that we can't have good public safety policy and compassion for the sickest of Minnesotans. And I really do appreciate that you came back to the table and worked with us to find something along that lines. I'm not going to say I'm personally in complete agreement with the spot you're at, but I do appreciate that we're back at the table and we are at this point today, because it's the right thing to do.
Representative Urusso.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Getting back to the issue of the number of facilities, I'm pretty uncomfortable with one. And this is from a manufacturing point of view. If you have one facility, you're extremely vulnerable to any of the, I could sit and reel off dozens of situations that could interrupt that or cause it to go away. And so, we don't have one major medical center in Minnesota. I don't even have one manufacturer of pacemakers and other medical devices in my district. We've got more than one of these things for really good reasons. Competition is good, but it's not only competition. It's also about reliability. When you go in and get a pacemaker put in right this minute, your doctor's going to tell you, I don't know if you're going to end up with Medtronic or St. Jude Leeds, because it's going to depend on the availability of that day and who's there. Because we've got two suppliers. And it's really critical when you're going to have people that are relying on this that we don't set ourselves up for, we go to all this work for these people and they're relying on it, and then something as simple as a fire could put everybody out of business that day. So I will cheerfully put my name on an amendment to increase that. We're kind of talking here what that number is going to be, but it's not one in my opinion. Thank you.
We have Representative Tyson Lean, but I want to ask the Commissioner of Public Safety, do you have a statement or do you want to provide any testimony? Are you in a position to provide any testimony? Okay. And Mr. Franklin, as I see, is here. Is Mr. Franklin? He is here. Would you like to? We'd like you to come down and just to explain what the position of the Sheriff's Association is. This is the we're trying to. Representative Lesh had to leave, and so we're going to have another hearing on the civil matter because we're just not going to get to it tonight. But I want to get all of the testimony that would be under the purview of the Committee on Public Safety on record tonight.
And Mr. Chair, as he's coming down, I think the questions for government operations, I think I've asked those questions that we have. So I think our, unless members of the government operation committee have more questions that would be in our purview, I think we've covered most of that as we went along.
Okay. Mr. Franklin?
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, Jim Franklin, Executive Director for the Sheriff's Association. Not to be redundant on everything that's been said, we have worked with members to try to come to the position that we are at right now. So at the present time, our position on the bill is that we remain neutral, and I'll just end it right there without going into any more detail.
Very good. Thank you for your testimony. Representative Tice.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Moline, there's just one point, and it probably doesn't go into the government operations part of it, but that just kind of keeps nagging at me, and I find it very curious. On line 3.27, when we talk about the manufacturers, we also look at the long-term financial stability of the manufacturer, and I'm not really sure how we're going to do that because I don't know that we're growing medical marijuana here right now. So I guess how do we take care of that provision?
Representative Moline.
Well, Mr. Chair, I think the idea is that a manufacturer who's already established themselves in another state and who has experience in this area would be one that would come to Minnesota and apply with the Minnesota Department of Health. So I think that that's why that's in there. Obviously, especially if we are going to only have one manufacturer serving 5,000 patients, I think that it's pretty important that it's somebody that knows what they're doing, maybe trying to avoid reinventing the wheel. So I think that's in there to sort of suggest that we would have a manufacturer come to Minnesota that already has experience and knowledge and financial stability in order to establish a site. I mean, there's going to be a lot of costs associated with the manufacturer establishing a site. A lot of costs that they're going to have to absorb up front. So I think that that's why that's going to be one of the considerations that the department makes in determining a manufacturer.
Representative Tice.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Moline, would it be possible, or I guess maybe I would suggest that maybe we do look at some language that it sounds like we're going to be very interested in adding more manufacturers, that maybe we do something so that we have a, I'm not sure if pun is intended or not, but a homegrown Minnesota company manufacturer do that, that is allowed, that we're not only going to restrict ourselves to out-of-state people who have done this before?
Sibeline, do you have a quick comment?
Yeah, Mr. Chair, I mean, I carry made-in-Minnesota bills all the time. That's kind of my thing. But in this circumstance, you know, I don't know that we would want to limit it necessarily to that. I mean, obviously, if a manufacturer comes in from another state, their employees are going to be here in Minnesota. They can have a Minnesota affiliate or something like that. But I do think it would be in the best interest of the program and the patients to have somebody with experience be the one that is approved by the commissioner. Ultimately, it's up to the commissioner, but that would be my intent.
Representative Lean.
Oh, thank you, Mr. Chair. Actually, my questioning was in the same line of Representative Tease, so my questions for this evening have largely been answered.
Sir, did you want to testify?
I'm sorry, Mr. Chair. David Cole, Minnesota Police Chiefs Association.
Oh, I'm sorry.
And you wanted law enforcement.
Yes,
so,
please.
We are part of the coalition, and the other representative spoke, and we do appreciate Representative Moline's work on this. We are also not opposed to this for the same reasons Mr. Flaherty articulated.
Very good. Thank you very much for your testimony. Is there anyone else in the audience that would like to testify? We're either for or against the bill. Anyone from law enforcement? Okay, Representative Neuberger.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Moline, I just have one last question that I just want to follow up with. I know you've had a lot of hearings. You've had a lot of hours into this. And I just wanted to reflect back on your committee hearings with Health and Human Services when you went through that whole process. What did the people from the medical community say about this? What did the physicians, what did the doctors, what did the pain specialists, what did the medical people say about this issue? Did they ask for this? Is this something that they're seeking? Is this something they think would be a good treatment modality? I mean, we're hearing from all the interested groups, which is good, but I'm sitting here wondering, where do the physicians weigh in on this?
Mr. Chair, and Representative, we didn't have any opposition testimony in Health and Human Services, to my recollection. There was broad-based support. It was a different bill. It was a more expansive bill than the one before you. The Minnesota Nurses Association has always been supportive of medical marijuana. They were supportive of the original bill. There is a letter now from the MS Society that is in support of this bill. I think that the feedback from the medical community is mixed, just like feedback from law enforcement is mixed. You know, I think that there's differing opinions within each profession, but I don't recall there being any opposition testimony from the medical community in Health and Human Services. Like I said, I think there's varying opinions.
Representative Cornish.
No, Mr. Chair, members, I told Representative Moline that I support her bill in its present form. I fear that it will change and probably have to drop off that. I hope not. I'd like to see it come much similar to this in pass. But the Department of Health testified the other night, and I think he's a doctor too, isn't he? He, I think, supported the idea and was willing to work on it and thought they could run a tight enough ship to make it work. But the medical community as a whole, I don't know if we've had like the American Medical Association supported or anybody else, but at least the Department of Health commissioner did the other night, I think.
Representative Liebling.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair. And, well, the representative of the Minnesota Medical Association is sitting in the back there. I don't know if he cares to come up, but what I understood from him, I think I asked him some time ago on the previous bill, I believe the MMA was neutral. at that time. But let me just say that I, my understanding is that medical professionals are really split about it, just like they're split about many treatments and medications. And if every medical professional agreed with every other, it would be a much simpler world, and we'd all know exactly what to do for our ailments, I think. But medicine is, in large part, an art, and the fact that, you know, even regular FDA-approved medications, you're going to have some physicians who are going to use one thing all the time, and then others who are going to use another. And to actually make them agree with each other, it's just not going to happen. So to me, the fact that medical professionals don't all agree isn't really the issue. It's whether a significant number of them feel that it would be useful for their patients. I think that's really the question, and my impression is that a significant number of them do.
Let's hear from the MMA.
Mr. Chair and members, Dave Renner with the Minnesota Medical Association. We have been trying to follow this. We have been trying to, as many different changes. I've had conversations with Representative Moline just today, and that we appreciate the changes she has made with this legislation. The original bill is introduced. We did take a position. Our board took a position saying that we did not support passage of that at this point, because there is more need for more data and more clinical research. In the most recent version that Representative Moline has now, matter of fact, we'll be getting her a letter tomorrow, we no longer oppose her legislation as drafted today. We are still opposed to the Senate version. We still think that goes too far, too fast, without more data gathering. But we think in the structure that she has here, it does allow us to start gathering that data. So we no longer oppose the legislation. Yeah. But Representative Liebling is correct. Physicians are all over the board on this. But as a medical association, that's what our position is.
Very good. Any questions? Thank you for your testimony. Is there anyone else? We're going to the Civil Law Committee will be meeting again, because Representative Lesch did not have an opportunity to go through all the data privacy issues that he was concerned about. So Representative Moline, you're going to have to do this one more time. But I appreciate your presenting the bill, and everybody that came down to testify, and members who stayed this late. This meeting is adjourned.
And members,
oh, I'm sorry.
That's okay. Members from the Government Operations Committee, the meeting we were going to be having after this, there's been changes to that bill that we would have to hear, so we don't have to hear it anymore. So our meeting that's after has been canceled. You're free to go home.